Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The state opened up eligibility for the COVID-19 vaccine to Vermonters age 70 and above at 8:15 this morning. Within the first 15 minutes, 7,000 people had registered, and the call center was experiencing an overload. By the time the regular 11 a.m. press conference rolled around, Human Services Secretary Mike Smith said fully a third of all the Vermonters in this newly eligible age band have already registered for an appointment. And Governor Phil Scott said later that people should expect the next age band, those age 65 and above, to become eligible within a couple of weeks. The federal government has continued to announce increasing allocations to states week over week and expects the Food and Drug Administration to grant emergency use authorization to a one-dose vaccine from Johnson & Johnson by the end of the month. So today in our weekly health update, we'll talk about what this all means for vaccination rollout in Vermont. We'll also discuss COVID variants and new CDC guidelines about the distances required between elementary school students that differ from Vermont's guidelines. Education Secretary Dan French says he feels confident that Vermont's guidelines are good for our state and doesn't expect to change them. Joining us for this hour to go over all of this and more is Deputy Health Commissioner. Now I'm elevating you, Tracy. Tracy Dolan, nice to have you back with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to the larger paycheck along with the promotion you've just given me.
Well, you know, I have that kind of power here in the state, I'm happy to announce. Let's start, Deputy Commissioner, by talking a little bit about that vaccine eligibility and the opening up of a new age band. So previously it had been Vermonters age 75 and above. Now Vermonters who are having their 70th birthday today or are older than that are eligible to get the vaccine and to register for the vaccine today and to start getting it very shortly. So are you surprised by how many people signed up immediately upon eligibility?
I have to say we were a little surprised. We got, I think, 7,000 calls in the first
15 minutes.
Maybe 15 minutes, which was, you know, they're 70 and they're enthusiastic, it turns out. We got a lot of people registered already, a third, which is incredible. I think it helped that a lot of people went in early and created an account so that when you went in, you didn't have to do that extra step. You were able to go right to choosing an appointment.
Although that would really be for the website, right? Not just the call center.
That's true. Yeah. So we got a lot of people registered through the website. But of course, yes, the call center also got a lot of calls. So, but the registration numbers, I think a lot of that is also people going in and getting that account early, which really helps as well.
And so remind people what the phone number is they can call if they need to call for an appointment or if they need to cancel an appointment that they had for today because of weather.
Yes, that number is 855-722-7878.
And the website, which you would prefer people to use for making an appointment.
Yeah, the website will get you there quickly and easily. It's healthvermont.gov/myvaccine. But if you just go to healthvermont.gov, you will see the COVID-19 and the big banner that says if you're 70 and over, click here. So that's the easy way to sign up. It's quick, you know, relatively easy. We've tried to make that more simple based on some feedback that we got. So that's your best option because you may be on hold a little bit today and possibly a little bit tomorrow on the phone because so many people are calling. So our preference would be if you can go to that website first and give that a try.
And you are asking people of any age to go ahead and register, not for an appointment date, but to register their information on that website now because then when they become eligible, it will be an easier process. So can any adults do that now?
Yeah, you can go in and create an account now. And so you can go in and create an account. And then when it gets to the time that it's your time to be vaccinated, you would then be just going in to look for an appointment. I would most encourage it for people 65 and older right now.
And those who have already used the state website to get a COVID-19 test are in the system already, right?
You are already in the system, yep. You already have an account.
Okay, so you're not making a new account. If you've gotten a COVID-19 test through that state system, you've put in your information in the website, you're already in there. You're not trying to create a new account. That's the account that you should be using.
That's right. That is your account. And then you'll have the choice of choosing, are you looking for a test or a vaccine? So that account will give you that option.
So how many, we expect, we heard today in the press briefing that the next age band will be opened up within a couple of weeks, which would be significantly faster than it was for the gap between these two previous age bands. So are you anticipating that because of the increased allocation of federal doses that we should see those age 65 and above just within a couple of weeks being able to schedule appointments?
Absolutely. It's moving quickly, and especially with the increase in vaccine, we certainly have the capacity to move people through the system quickly. And so we will open it up just as soon as it looks like we have enough vaccine. Again, you know, the key to what we're doing in Vermont to ensure that stress is lower and to ensure that the vaccine gets to the right people at the right time is making sure that when people go in, there is an appointment for them versus having to go on a waiting list or finding out that they've come in too late. So when you go in, when we're opening up these age groupings, it's with the knowledge that you can be confident, you can go in and there will be an appointment for you and there is a vaccine for you.
And then, so just to clarify, I did get a question on Twitter today that after the age 70 and above, it will be age 65 and above. And after that, it will be those who have specified medical conditions. Those two groups won't be combined?
I can't say for certain. Certainly 70 and above is now, 65 and above. But all of those groups continue. So, for example, 65 and above will open, and it could be soon after, depending on how much vaccine we have, that we move to chronic conditions or to the high-risk medical conditions. So we may have some overlap, but it will be 70 and above now, then 65 and above, and then we may either take a few weeks or maybe even move more quickly to chronic conditions, depending on how quickly we're able to vaccinate people.
Listeners, if you have a question for Deputy Commissioner Dolan, you can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or email vermontedition at vpr.org. We got a question from a listener about one of those severe health conditions that will get priority in vaccination after the age bands. And this listener wrote in, I was wondering if Deputy Commissioner Dolan could talk more about obesity and COVID and how dangerous it is. I feel like I'm just realizing and reading that this is a leading risk factor for being hospitalized and death from COVID. One article I read said moderately obese people were something like 114% more likely to be hospitalized. Even though I am obese, I am very active, hike daily, bike, ski. I'm in my 30s, have no other conditions. I was feeling like I was in pretty good shape to be okay if I got COVID. Now I'm realizing that is totally not true. So the questions are, how much increased risk is there for people with obesity? And then I have a follow-up question for you as well, Deputy Commissioner.
Sure. If you go on our website, you will see the list of high-risk medical conditions. So those are the conditions where if you already have that condition and then you were to get COVID-19, your outcomes would be worse. You could become more ill. And so when you see obesity listed there, that is one of the conditions. And I believe we have defined obesity a little more specifically.
Well, actually, that is the follow-up question. So since you're going there, let's go there, because it's not defined specifically on the state website in the, who's next for eligibility guidelines. I think it says severe obesity.
Yes.
So, yeah, how are you defining obesity for the purposes of who would be eligible to get the vaccine in that grouping?
And so we haven't sorted all of that out yet. But when you eventually get to the high-risk medical conditions phase with registration, you will be able to self-attest, and there will be a definition of what we mean by more severe obesity. So there is some heightened risk with any obesity, but there's more significant heightened risk with severe obesity. And because of limited vaccine, and because we're trying to prioritize toward those who are at highest risk, it's why we have narrowed that definition of obesity for the purposes of this vaccination and this category. And so we don't have the full definition at this time, but it will be not just the broad definition of obesity. It will likely be a different BMI that narrows it so that we're talking specifically about people with possibly morbid obesity or an obesity that is beyond that first level of obesity that often people feel that they're part of.
Yeah, I mean, it could become complicated, right? Because you may be in touch with a healthcare provider who has told you your BMI or who you're working with on this issue, but perhaps you're not, and perhaps your weight fluctuates. You know, it could be challenging to determine whether you're in that severe obesity category or not at the moment that you're able to register for a vaccine, and how to sort of determine and self-attest or to know whether you're in that category or not could be a challenge for some people.
It could be a challenge. And again, we're going to try to err on the side of making this as easy for people as possible. And so we're going to do our best to describe things in such a way that people would recognize, okay, I've been diagnosed with that, or I've been, the last time I was at a doctor's office, I was diagnosed with that, or my primary care provider would have me listed in that category, something along those lines. But again, we don't have a final definition on that, but we will have a definition that makes sense to people when they open it up.
So we got a note from Joanne specifically about an experience today. Joanne says, I wanted to share our experience trying to schedule a vaccine for my husband, who's in the group allowed to be vaccinated now. The Vermont Health Department on its website states that there are enough appointments for everyone in the 70-plus group. However, every link to register online, at least today, states that there are no available appointments, none with the state, none with the pharmacies listed. Joanne goes on to say, we were able to schedule an appointment over the phone. I think the rollout and scheduling needs some work, especially if every Walgreens and Kinney Drug, for example, is not giving the vaccine, then only the pharmacies with appointments, if any, should be listed. I cannot explain why the state had the same message. So what can you tell Joanne?
It's possible. So for Walgreens, we do know that Walgreens is only scheduling 3 days out. And so in a lot of areas, Walgreens may not be showing any appointments because they're doing some short time scheduling right now. But for the Department of Health appointments, it's possible if you're choosing appointments, for example, within the next 7 days, by the time you get there, it may say that you don't have an appointment. But if you choose an appointment farther out, so a longer period of time, that's where you'll see appointments become available. So it's possible someone's choosing a period, and then by the time they get to that period in the registration system, then it's showing that it's already full, that appointment time. But we do have appointments available. Possibly there was a glitch as she was in this registration system this morning. But generally, there are plenty of appointments available. There are thousands of appointments available. They might be just a little farther out, and possibly the first time frame that you put in might have been too short.
What day are those who are in that 70-plus category actually going to start getting vaccinated? I know registration opened today, but when's the first day those 70 to 74 might be getting it?
I believe that we have appointments this week, starting tomorrow, actually. I think we had some availability as well.
Okay. Let's go to Bess, who's calling in from Peacham. Hi, Bess. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, here's my question. If I get vaccinated and my three friends get vaccinated and we all want to be together and do something in a house for 2 hours, like just hang out, can we all take our masks off and be together because we've all been vaccinated? And I guess the other more clarifying question is, way back when I heard that after you got your first vaccine, I thought they said you were like 50%, covered, and then the second vaccine, you were 95% covered. So after you get your first vaccine, you're doing better, right? I mean, you're more safe. So I guess that's my question. Hopefully you understand it.
I think we got it, Bess. And so let's tackle that second one first. After the first dose, you start to gain that immunity, right, Deputy Commissioner? But yes, the second dose will boost it up to that researched 95% level.
You're right. After the first dose, you do have some protection. 14 days after the second dose, that's when you get up to the most effective level. And again, that's most effective for, severe illness and death. And in the case of some vaccines, even most effective for more mild symptoms. And so you are more protected then. However, because we're still in the process of vaccinating a lot of people in Vermont, we've already vaccinated 14%, which is great, but we're still moving on that. We are asking people to continue with the masking guidelines and the gathering guidelines. And I know that's frustrating. I know people want to get together, but we're asking you to continue with these guidelines right now. The governor's executive order is still in effect, and you will see changes in that eventually. But right now we're asking people to not change their behavior much.
So there are two parts to that, though, right? I mean, one is legally, the governor's executive order still stands. We are not allowed to have multi-household gatherings. However, I think to Bess's question as well, there's also the idea of, you know, in terms of health safety, what's possible. And so, you know, I don't I'm not asking you to parse this so that people can break the rules, but I think it's important to know, you know, in terms of health, is it safe to gather with others who have also been fully vaccinated once the governor changes the executive order?
I think I'll wait and see when the governor decides to change the executive order. Certainly, we know there's more protection 14 days after you receive your final vaccination. And so we would encourage people who are gathering with others to hold on those gatherings and certainly to continue to mask. And again, you don't always know when you're gathering with people. I mean, one of the challenges is you may be gathering with people and maybe most of them have been vaccinated, but maybe one hasn't because they're not in the age group yet. And so it gets a little tricky for us to say, go ahead and move forward. So it's best for to really look at the guidance and continue with not gathering at this time. And again, looking to the governor eventually to make some changes as we see more people get vaccinated.
There is one change, though, that the governor has said he'll follow based on CDC guidance, and this is changes around quarantine requirements for people who have been exposed to COVID-19 but who have already been vaccinated and are at least 14 days out from their second dose, but within 3 months of getting the vaccine. Those people no longer have to quarantine if they know themselves to have been exposed to someone with COVID-19, correct?
That's right. So if you've received both of your vaccinations and it's been 2 weeks, so you're 2 weeks out from your second vaccination, and then you find out you're a close contact of a case, you do not have to quarantine.
Let's go to Deborah. Deborah's calling in from South Burlington. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hello. I am just wondering what vaccine we get here in Vermont. Do we get the Moderna or the Pfizer, or can we choose?
Deborah, thanks. Vermont is getting both vaccines, right, Deputy Commissioner? But you do not get to choose which one you get.
That's right. We're getting both vaccines. If there are more vaccines that come in, we will get those vaccines as well. And no, we don't open it up for choice. That could become very challenging. And so we take the vaccine we get. Again, all the vaccines, the Johnson vaccine coming in too, is showing highly effective against the most significant outcome, which would be death or severe illness. So all the vaccines actually are equally effective at preventing death and severe illness from COVID-19. And so we're lucky to have vaccines that are showing great effectiveness, and they will all be available, and hopefully Johnson in a few weeks as well.
But you will know which type of vaccine you got, the Moderna or the Pfizer. You will be told, yes?
Yeah, you're either told or you can ask. I'm not certain if there's a sign up or not. So I don't know if there's signage that tells you, but once you arrive at the clinic, you will certainly know.
And you can also extrapolate based on when your second appointment is, because there's different guidelines around when you're supposed to have your second dose.
Yeah, there's, I think, 21 days versus 28 days. So that's another way to look at it. Yeah.
So you and others have mentioned the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is not yet approved for use in this country. But Miriam, who's also calling in from South Burlington, I believe has a question about that. Miriam, go right ahead.
Oh, hi there. Just wondering, I think it was Dr. Levine that mentioned the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But he said, in addition, for emergency use. And so that's the word that kind of, you know, struck me because I'd like to know what he referred to when he said that.
Yeah, Miriam, thanks for that. So what the doctor was referring to is that the Food and Drug Administration is granting emergency use authorization to these vaccines that have been approved, so the Moderna and the Pfizer, and expected soon to be the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Deputy Commissioner, can you describe the difference between an emergency use authorization and an authorization that is more general, not emergency use?
Yeah, so usually the emergency use authorization in this case is coming in based on the place we are in the research. And so they've seen enough evidence and they've had thorough safety studies to show that it's safe. But because of the length of time, it has been given emergency use authorization. You will see eventually that will shift into a general use authorization. But because we are in a pandemic, and it has been proven effective. The authorization that all of the vaccines, not just Johnson, are given right now, so the other two as well, is emergency use authorization. And we're confident, and that doesn't mean, therefore, that they're not safe. It just means, given the accelerated timeline, that's the authorization they give it. And as studies continue and as timing continues, that will eventually shift to a general use authorization.
Seth is on the line with us from Norwich. Hi, Seth. What's your question?
Hi there. I may be wrong about this, but my understanding is that none of the vaccines have been approved for people under the age of 16. And if that's true, I'm just wondering why that is, and also what the plan would be for vaccinating them, given that they make up such a large portion of the school-age population.
Seth, thanks for that question. Yeah, Deputy Commissioner, I've been hearing more about studies underway in children to try to figure out when and how they could authorize use for those under 16 or 18, depending on the type of the vaccine.
Yes, it's a great question, and we would all love to see the vaccines available for everyone. However, it's based on the studies that are initially done. So the studies initially were done on adults, and those were moved through the process in order to get to this emergency use authorization so we could move on what we know is effective in preventing and mitigating the outcomes from COVID-19. So now those same vaccine manufacturers are moving forward on studies on children. And as soon as they also reach the level where they can go to the FDA and ask for that approval for the use of these vaccines on those 16 and under, then hopefully we will open up to see that. But we don't anticipate that will be for at least a few more months.
Yeah. Do you have any more narrowing down than you can do on that?
I don't, unfortunately, but I know that the studies are underway now.
Let's go to Susan. Susan's calling in from Richmond. Go right ahead.
Hi. My family and I are going to be at Jay Peak next week in two separate condos, one and two households. And we'd like to get together outside or to do some activities. Jay Peak has said that the state will not allow two households in their Olympic-sized rink. And yet they're allowing teams to come in and play hockey. So if we're of seven people masked in two households, it's kind of a head-scratcher that we can't skate in this giant rink when teams from obviously lots of households and coaches are allowed in the rink.
And, Susan, the teams that you're talking about are school-based and or youth rec league-based teams?
Correct. Hockey. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about that, Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, it sort of goes along with the same thinking that kids from different households can gather in a school because there's a structured environment with very clear rules on it. And there are people, teachers who are monitoring and managing that situation. And so that's an example of it's a gathering of people from different households, but it's allowable because there is a structure around it and rules around it. And in the same way, and I know it's frustrating and I know you'd love to get together, but in the same way, these teams actually have guidelines and rules around masking. Some of those teams are actually getting tested more frequently, depending on if it's college or high school teams. And so there is a little more structure around that. And again, I'm sure that with the best of intentions, you would probably get together with your family and mask, but there are some very clear rules and accountability around the teams. And so it does lower the risk. And that's why you see that sometimes it's allowed in a more structured environment, but not in an unstructured environment.
It seems, Deputy Commissioner, that in addition to the structure and the rules and the sort of rigidity around school-based and youth rec league sports, there's also a little bit of a prioritization that the state is giving to those kinds of activities over other kinds of activities because the state, Governor Scott has said, Education Secretary Dan French has said, Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine has said, they've all talked about the toll, the mental toll of the pandemic on young people. And so opening up youth sports has partly been in response to an understanding of how difficult this has been for young people. Not to say it's not difficult for households either, but it does seem like the state is prioritizing this kind of activity for young people, partly because of that mental health toll that it has taken to not be able to go to school or participate in these things.
Absolutely. In the same way, now that music is involved in that as well, you know, allowing people, young people, to do some of the things that they enjoy doing at a time when it's very stressful. I mean, it's really part of why, as Vermont, we took a somewhat unique approach to compared to some other states with our low positivity rate and ensured that most kids could keep going to school, at least on a part-time basis, with part-time in person. It's, again, that the importance of kids getting together, getting education, some interacting with each other for the mental health benefits, and then the physical health benefits of sports as well. So all of those reasons add in. And then in addition to what I mentioned around the structure and the rules with the masks and the distancing.
Let's take Joseph, who's on the line with us from St. Johnsbury. Joseph, go right ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, I've noticed in this all the cut and thrust of the epidemic that there's a lot of people who practice the casual drug use with the legalized marijuana, and they don't hesitate to share a pipe or, you know, in some cases, promiscuity, and even brag about going out of state to New York and, you know, meeting a boyfriend that they're not even long-term friends, they're just promiscuity. And the state is, in a sense, embracing behavior that traditionally has been disdained. And now, in light of an epidemic-type situation, it seems like a lot of this is being sanitized in various conversations and things. It's not part of the equation, in a sense, when in reality it can be witnessed.
Joseph, are you saying that you think legalized cannabis use leads to dangerous behaviors, and this, you think that, especially in light of the pandemic, that's something that the state should be addressing? Is that sort of the thrust of your point here?
Right. You know, if they're saying people should quarantine and watch their behavior and wash their hands, and then there's a significant amount of society that's addicted to various types of drugs, not just marijuana, they're obviously not going to follow protocol when they're satisfying their addictions that more and more society seems to be embracing as some kind of legal right nowadays.
Well, let's put some of this to Deputy Commissioner Dolan. I don't think you're necessarily correct that someone who is using a drug, whether it's legal or illegal, is necessarily not going to be following quarantine rules. However, there are cases in which the state has said, essentially, you know, your safety is more important than the rules. And I'm thinking specifically, Deputy Commissioner, around people who are using certain types of illicit drugs that you would want to have a buddy around for who could, you know, if you're taking an opiate and you might need to have Narcan if you overdose, or if your drug has fentanyl in it, whether you anticipate that it does or not, you might need to have Narcan administered to you. And so you're going to need to have somebody around. And I've heard the Department of Mental Health and the Department of Health say, you know, that's more important. Surviving is more important than not having that other household with you. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you know, this is a tricky area. So we've got this bigger backdrop of a COVID pandemic, right? And so there are things we should be doing. But then within that, you also have this subgroups of people who are sometimes engaging in really high risk behaviors, regardless of the pandemic, that would put them at incredibly high risk for overdose or death. And in those cases, we also have guidance around that. And it's about risk reduction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your caller's right. Is there a risk when you get together with someone else from another household and you don't mask, regardless of what you do? Absolutely, there is. There's an incredibly high risk when you use drugs alone, particularly with drugs that may include fentanyl, for example. And we know that a fentanyl overdose can easily lead to death. And this is something important to remember in this pandemic. Nothing else stopped, you know? So all the other issues that were issues a year and a half ago continue to be. We continue to see overdoses. I was talking to Dr. Shapiro at our medical examiner's office. He's our chief medical examiner. And he said he has noticed that throughout the pandemic, the crutches that people have, the things that people go to when they're stressed out, they have gone to even more so. And he's seeing a lot of that. So, you know, your caller's right. I do understand the concern there. However, we look at relative risk and risk reduction. And even though there is a risk getting together with someone because of COVID, there's even a higher risk if you're doing drugs with fentanyl, and especially if you're doing them alone. And so we do encourage people, if they're choosing that behavior, ideally not to, but if they are, to have somebody with you and to have Narcan available.
Yes. And, you know, just sort of on the other side of that, if someone is using cannabis legally or smoking a cigarette or having a gin and tonic or having a cranberry juice, they need to be following the guidelines around social distancing, not having multi-household gatherings. You know, generally speaking, beyond the sort of harm reduction issue, people in whatever activities they're engaging in should be following the guidelines.
They should be, yeah. And certainly sharing a drink, sharing a cigarette, sharing a joint, all of that, of course, can pass COVID.
Susan is with us from Brandon. Susan, hi, go right ahead.
Hi there. I just wondered, my husband is getting vaccinated tomorrow. He's in the next band of vaccinations, and I will not qualify for some months. Is there any risk once you get vaccinated of passing COVID along? Like, I know I've had some vaccinations where they're like, stay away from anybody who's at risk for a while. Is there any risk of passing COVID on through the vaccine?
Yeah, Susan, I'm glad you asked. Deputy Commissioner, clarify for Susan. Her husband is going to get the vaccine. He cannot pass COVID-19 along to anyone.
Yeah, just to be clear, I think you're asking, is there a risk to pass it on through the vaccine? The vaccine isn't the COVID-19 virus. The vaccine triggers your immune system to get ready to fight it, which is why he may have some symptoms, but those won't be symptoms of actually having COVID-19. So there's no risk to you from getting COVID-19 from your husband in that way. Now, it's possible he has COVID before he gets his vaccination, and that would be a different case if he happened to be positive in advance and didn't know it. But generally, you're not at any risk from being around someone with the vaccine. In fact, you're generally at higher protection.
We got news last week that although the state of Vermont's genomic sequencing had not yet revealed the presence of B117, a COVID variant, in the state officially, there were two mutations discovered in wastewater in Burlington that suggest the presence of this variant here in the state. So far, testing has not revealed officially that that variant is here, but it does appear likely that it's in Burlington, if not elsewhere. Joining us now is Lynn Blevins, a medical epidemiologist with the Vermont Department of Health, who can help us understand a little bit about these variants, including B117, and what we need to know about their presence here in Vermont. Lynn Blevins, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So explain what it means that these two mutations were found in Burlington wastewater, which suggest that this variant is present, but we haven't officially confirmed that. That sounds confusing, and maybe I'm not saying it very clearly. So you can explain better than I.
Sure. Well, when wastewater is collected, it's a pooled sample. So they're casting a wide net here, and which increases the likelihood that something will be found, but they're not looking for the entire variant. They're just looking for little pieces of nucleic acid that suggest that a variant is present. So they're looking for the specific mutations that are associated with hypertransmissibility. So it's, instead of finding the actual variant, they're finding fragments of the variant that suggests that the variant is likely here.
And do you think that the variant is here, even though the actual samples that have been so far tested by the state haven't shown the presence of that variant? But, you know, given what we know about Burlington wastewater, does it seem safe to assume that the variant is here?
Well, I think we've been considering it here for mm-hmm. quite a while. It's been in neighboring states, in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York. And so finding this in the wastewater is just one more piece of the puzzle to really suggest that it is likely here.
And this was the variant that was first discovered in the UK, but there are other variants of the virus as well that have been shown to be here in the United States and elsewhere in the world. So should we assume that any and all variants could be here? And if we assume that, what does that actually mean for how we should adjust our behavior?
Sure. So the B117 is present to the largest number in the United States based on our surveillance. And by our surveillance, I mean the surveillance going on in most or all of the states. The other two, B1351 and P1, have been found in a smaller number of states and to a smaller degree. So B117 is the variant that we have our eye on, and CDC modeling has suggested that based on the experience in the UK, that this could become the dominant virus in the United States by March.
Which would not be very far away from us. March starts at the end of next weekend.
Right.
And so if that's the case, what, if anything, does that mean for how we should adjust our behavior?
Sure. Well, it's, you know, more of the same, but I would say that we, you know, we need to close some gaps. So, for example, CDC just came out with some guidance on masks. They suggest that tightly fitting masks are much more effective than, you know, a floppy mask, if you will. So that's like a literal gap that we could close. There's also some policies that have been implemented at the federal level. They're requiring masks on public transportation. And this is because 6-foot distancing is not always possible, often not possible on public transportation. And so really then our only tool is masks. So this has not been a rule up until very recently, the last couple of weeks, and concerns about the variant have really pushed that rule to be implemented.
Sorry, go right ahead.
Yep. I mean, the other big piece is vaccination. In a way, it's sort of a race between vaccination and the variant. The more people that we have vaccinated, the fewer opportunities that the virus has to replicate. So viruses mutate when they replicate. So if we're decreasing transmission, then we can slow down the emergence of new variants by not allowing them to replicate, and also slow the spread of any variants that are found. And again, the one of concern, most concern because of how prevalent it is B117.
And one of the reasons that we would want to make sure that we are slowing the changes that this virus is making is because we're not sure in some cases, but also certainly for the potential for future variants, we're not sure how the vaccines that have been developed would like the effectiveness level against future variations of the virus.
That's correct. There are three what we call variants of concern. There are many, many variants overall because this virus mutates, and when it mutates, it creates a variant. A lot of those are not variants of concern. They may not stick around for very long. But the variants of concern are the B117, B1351, which emerged in South Africa, and P1, which is believed to have emerged in Brazil. And the B117 has been studied the best, but all of them are believed to be more transmissible than the former version of the virus to which they're replacing. The B1351 and the P1, there is some evidence that they may not be as they may not respond in the same way to vaccination, but vaccination will still be protective. In other words, even if there's a lower vaccine efficacy for these variants, it's still worth getting vaccinated because there's still some protection, especially from the most severe outcomes. So we want vaccines with a high efficacy, and but even if that efficacy is lowered, there's still some value to it.
Let's go to Daryl, who's calling in from Fletcher. Hi, Daryl. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my question was regarding these updated CDC guidelines for not having to quarantine once fully vaccinated if you come in contact with the virus. All the literature that I've looked at seems to say that the way the vaccines work is they don't actually prevent you from contracting COVID, that you'll still get it, you just won't get sick, and that you are still able to pass it on to other people once vaccinated. If that's the case, how does that How do these new guidelines work with that? Because it seems to me that the two would be in conflict with one another, and it would really be a safety issue.
Thanks for the question, Daryl. Lynn Blevins, can you explain what's known so far about whether those who are vaccinated have a lower risk of transmitting the virus to other people, even if they themselves don't get it or don't get a severe case?
Well, the initial messaging with this, that people who are vaccinated may still be able to have asymptomatic infection and share and spread that infection, was because this issue was really not looked at during the clinical trials. So the clinical trials happened very quickly, and in order to get the vaccines on the market, they did all of the things that they needed to do, but they did not look at asymptomatic infection. And that's really a hallmark and a sticking point of this disease. It's why this disease is so difficult to control. We do have good evidence that people don't often get repeat infection within 90 days of their first infection, so that there is some protective immunity here. And so the new CDC guidance allowing for people who are fully vaccinated to not have to quarantine after exposure for 90 days is in line with that repeat infection guidance.
So to Daryl's point, the literature that he says he's been reading that suggests that people can still transmit it, that's not clear. That's not necessarily a given. And the CDC guidance is based on what we know so far about how people are responding once they've been vaccinated in terms of their ability to transmit the virus.
Yes, and I would note that it's only for 90 days. So after 90 days, I mean, that time period may extend out past 90 days, or it may not. So it depends on the data. This is a CDC recommendation, not a Vermont Department of Health recommendation. So in this case, we are following the CDC recommendation for not having to quarantine after exposure for a fully vaccinated person.
Lynn, is there anything else while we have you that you think Vermonters maybe don't know or don't have at the forefront of their minds that we should know?
Well, I think that I would say even when if a variant is not more severe, if it's just more transmissible, it can lead to more disease. And so we might see more hospitalizations and more deaths. So it may seem like it's more severe, but it's actually really just more transmissible. And so this is why, you know, we really emphasize keeping up with the mask wearing, keeping up with physical distancing, reducing social contacts, and getting vaccinated when you're eligible to do that.
That's Lynn Blevins. Lynn is a medical epidemiologist with the Vermont Department of Health. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We still have Tracy Dolan with us, Deputy Health Commissioner, for a few more minutes, and we have several more topics that we can at least touch on this week and then maybe dive more in depth into next time we have you on, which may be next Tuesday, Deputy Commissioner. One is a note that we got from Laura in Versher, who says, I know that homebound elders who need a COVID vaccine are being identified by visiting nurse organizations and are being vaccinated by visiting nurses and EMS providers. But if homebound elders are not affiliated with a visiting nurse organization, how are they being identified? And Laura says, I ask as a volunteer EMS provider in my town and as a concerned neighbor.
Yeah, great question. So we're doing it a few ways. First, it's through the home health agencies. And then we're looking at hospitals. And so hospitals will provide us lists of anyone they're working with who they provide services to who is homebound but not affiliated with a home health service, also primary care practices. So we're actually working through a few different healthcare avenues. But if someone is homebound and doesn't get their services through any of those and is unable to identify who they actually go to, that let's say they don't have a doctor or they don't have somebody who regularly visits them, they could call their area agency on aging and provide their information there. But for the most part, most people are either covered through home health or through hospitals, through their care or through a primary care provider. And we're working with all of those partners. And in the coming couple of weeks, we will continue to expand. And as we get more vaccine in and our systems get stronger and we get more of these lists, we will get out there and be vaccinating. I think we've vaccinated about 900 so far who are homebound. And those numbers should be picking up now as we get more and more communities on board.
Speaking of people who may not be connected to services in a very identifiable way, how is Vermont making sure that homeless and unsheltered Vermonters who are eligible through their age bands are actually getting access to the vaccine?
That's a great question. So we are working through community organizations and community agencies to help identify vulnerable Vermonters. And so working through our partners who work with the homeless, our partners who work with other types of groups, and helping them register. We probably don't have high numbers in the 70 plus category, and we will engage in more of those efforts as the age drops as well. And certainly we have a lot of overlap there with the chronic disease, the high risk medical conditions.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came out with new guidelines for schools around the country. Many schools that haven't necessarily been open for in-person instruction are trying to open for in-person instruction, partly in line with new President Joe Biden's push to make sure that schools are open. And among the CDC guidelines, it says that it advises that all elementary age students have a minimum of 6 feet of distance between them. Vermont-specific guidelines were amended before school started in the fall to allow 3 to 6 feet of distance for the youngest students, the elementary age students in Vermont. Dan French said today in the press conference he doesn't anticipate changing Vermont's guidelines. And in fact, he thinks Vermont's guidelines are good for Vermont and for the level of community transmission in the state. But it does seem like we are now at odds with best practices, according to the CDC.
You know, this isn't actually the first time where we followed CDC but had a little variation. And some of that is really based on what we've been doing in Vermont and keeping our positivity rate low. For example, in many other states, you had to quarantine a full 14 days if you were a close contact and you couldn't test out. We allowed testing out at 7 days a long time ago, in part but because we had a low positivity rate. And we have shown that that's worked for us. In the same way in elementary schools, because our positivity rate was low, we had kids in school half time at the time. We were seeing the rate stay low. We were seeing all of our measures be pretty effective. So we were able to make that adjustment based on the data that we had in Vermont. If our situation were to change significantly, if the variant was, to change our landscape, of course, we would revisit. But right now, it looks like it's the right approach and it has served us well and it served the kids well to be able to be in school more.
Speaking of schools, Matt tweeted us wondering about a high number of schools in Franklin County that are remote this week because of COVID outbreaks and wants to know if that's related to staffing levels, that the schools are unable to fully staff because of those who need to quarantine, or if it's because of such high levels of COVID in the schools.
So the health department would rarely suggest that a school close unless the levels were very high. So it's likely that it's because of staffing or sometimes because enough of the staff, not necessarily that they're COVID positive, but sometimes a lot of them need to quarantine. And so staffing usually is the impact there. Again, in Franklin County, we do have some rising numbers. We haven't had a lot of outbreaks. So we think it's primarily community transmission, but there have been a couple of schools involved. And so it's likely the staffing because we have not necessarily advised that to the best of my knowledge.
That's Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. Thank you, as always, for sharing your time and knowledge with us.
Thank you very much.